The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hey, what's up? Welcome back to the show. I'm recording this intro from my hotel room in Savannah, Georgia. About to head to Charleston and then on to Wilmington and then the Outer Banks. I recorded a series of podcasts while I was in Florida at the Florida Surf Film Festival, one with Derek Hind, which includes, undoubtedly the greatest 20 minutes of audio that I've ever recorded. Derek's storytelling is unparalleled. The episode's actually 2 hours, but there's a 20 to 30 minute segment in there that is just jaw dropping. So look forward to that. Then I did a interview, kind of co-interview with Marcus Sanders. He and I interviewed Momentum Generation filmmaker Michael Zimbalist. Then I got to interview a few surfboard shapers, Matt Keckley, Bruce Reagan from Quiet Flight, Ricky Carroll, and then I'm going to cap off the series with CJ Hobgood. So that Florida series will be released in about a month. You can look forward to that. Today's show was recorded on Maui, and there's a really kind of much richer story to tell about Maui than what I'm going to do here. I would love to do a series on that island because there's just so much richness, such characters, such variety of waves. Lahaina was the capital of Hawaii from 1820 to 1845, so there's political history there. It's just a really fascinating place. But I was there mainly on a family vacation, so I didn't spend too much time recording podcasts. Recording with Jeff Timponi, however, was a necessity for me, for reasons that'll be obvious as you listen. He's been building boards for 50 years. He's worked alongside all the icons. He's still currently on the cutting edge of sustainable surfboard construction, thanks mainly to the guidance from his son and laminator, Nick. And his origin story and journey to Hawaii took place in a very interesting time in American history. So I know that you'll enjoy Jeff's story. Quick reminder, though, before we get into that, Spy is going to gift a $500 gift card to one person who uses our promo code in the month of November before the 20th, so about 5 days from now. All that you need to do to be entered to win that is purchase a pair of sunglasses or goggles on spyoptic.com. Use our promo code podcast, and then you'll be entered to win. From those names, I'll randomly select a winner and then announce it on Instagram on November 20th. You can use that $500 gift card on spyoptic.com to do your holiday shopping or just build out a quiver of sunglasses for yourself. And then we're going to do it again in December. So another $500 gift card that'll be picked on December 20th. Spy was the first sponsor partnership for us here on this podcast. So you guys, the listeners, have shown a lot of support, and then they just wanted to do something nice for the holidays, and that's it. $1,000 gift distributed amongst two lucky listeners. Thank you. SpyOptic.com, promo code podcast. Okay, this is David Scales for Surf Splendor. Enjoy my conversation with Jeff Timponi.
And it wasn't that long ago. I mean, we got here in 89.
So it wasn't like the early days.
No. I have friends that were here in the late '60s and '70s, and they said it was just, you know, like the old West. You know, it was pretty wide open. But you know, there was no Costco, no Kmart, no Lowe's. You had all your shopping at. There was Foodland, but that was downtown. So if you lived up country, you know, Makawao, Pukalani, and or Haiku side, Paia, you were shopping at these little mom and pop stores.
Yeah,
you know, then you know, I can name three or four of them. But the prices were just, you know, a box of cream of wheat was $8.50.
Right, you know?
It was pretty interesting.
Yeah. Cheers, by the way.
Oh, big mahalo.
Officially,
thank you, David.
Great to finally get this
sit
down opportunity.
Yeah, no, this is wonderful. I'm stoked.
Awesome. We're drinking tequila and mango lemonade mid-afternoon. Well, let's start.
I'm glad you qualified that.
Yes.
Mid-afternoon. It's like 3.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, it's 3 o'clock. Firstly, my board's working perfectly.
Oh, stoked.
Working out amazingly well.
Stoked. Oh, the one I loaned you yesterday.
No, the one that that one too. The one that I actually had you guys make. Do you want to describe what you made?
Well, it's a design we call the Pill, and it's kind of, you know, it's a performance board, but it's low rocker, usually a little wider, a little more volume. Say 90% of the ones I've done have been rounded pins or round tails, and it's more of a small wave design that's for Hawaiian waters. You know, you could push it up a little bit with the right fins. It was just, you know, trying to do something a little bit different that wasn't a fish.
Yeah. I think you and I had the conversation in the water yesterday, but I wanted to rehab it for listeners because they go through the process of working with shapers and trying to communicate what their needs and wants are and all that sort of stuff. And what I was explaining to you was like, I think that I have done myself a disservice in the past by giving shapers too much information. Mm-hmm. And I think that they are then trying to accommodate my requests and potentially not exploring what it is that they would normally explore. Because, by the way, they are craftsmen on a journey, constantly getting better. And then if somebody comes in and gives them conflicting information with whatever their journey is, they're going to go ahead and accommodate that customer. So my thought was like, okay, I don't want to make that mistake again. And I don't know what the waves are like in Maui. And you've been here for 30-plus years. So here's what I will tell you. I've been riding a fish all summer. The one thing that I don't want is a high-performance shortboard because I know even though I can ride them and I still ride them occasionally, I need good waves to ride them in. So that is a limited window of kind of where I could use it. So I've been riding a fish. I've been having a blast on the fish. But the reality is I don't need another fish. So if I was just bringing boards out here, I'd bring a fish or two and probably try to ride that. But I'm not doing that, and I don't want the fish. But I would like something that is rippable and a short board. So what do you got? And that's basically the Pill is what you came up with. 5'8".
Yeah. And like I said, it's a little wider. Maybe just and I was, you know, as a shaper, you know, I've always said, hey, more information you give me, the better. But I'm going to take it and guide it into a workable project. You know, if you give me, and I get tons of requests because all I do is really is custom orders.
Right.
So I get lots of different design theory, but I'll tweak it into something. Okay, I know this is going to work. You know, I kind of have like I was telling Nick this morning, hey, if we weren't doing something right, we wouldn't still be here after almost 50 years of shaping. So I always tweak them. You know, they can tell me what they want or they bring in someone else's board. Well, this is what I've been riding on, but I'll take it and I'll kind of turn it into a Timpony.
Right.
That's just, and try to make them, you know, user friendly. That's been kind of my thing is I try to make them so they're easy to ride, a little more durable than some. Are you going to be doing aerials? Then you don't need a single 6 deck and a single 4 bottom board.
Right. Right.
You know, I'd rather the customer got their money's worth.
Right. Well, what's interesting about the board that you made me is everybody who's trying to give somebody advice who's going to be coming and surfing in Hawaii always says foam is your friend. Because especially being from Southern California, you underestimate just powerful Hawaiian waves. Mm-hmm. And so knowing that you were building me the 5'8", and it's EPS, but we should get into the construction. But knowing that you were building me a 5'8", I was like, you know what you're doing, so I'm not going to question your decision. But, man, will that hold in juicier surf? Mm-hmm. I mean, we haven't surfed anything big, but the waves do certainly have more power and meat than they do at home. And the board has absolutely held. Like, and I put bigger fins in it, but the board, it hasn't once. It feels skatey and rippable, like a lot of shortboards I ride at home, but with no real deficit because of the wave size. I thought it might sketch out a little bit. Hasn't at all. Like in steep drops going right into a bottom turn with a lot of speed and drive, it holds completely. So it works. It just works.
Now, and it would probably work in a little more size than you might imagine. Because, okay. You know, Nick rides them. He's kind of kooky, you know, like a lot of the kids that were kind of born and raised here. He'll go out when it's big, and he's riding a 5'11", you know. And like, I just come from a different generation.
Yeah.
You know, so all my, oh, God, my smallest board's a 7'10", you know. And
yeah.
And then go up from there, you know, whatever.
But does he, do those boards work for him? Do his small boards work correctly in
yes.
those waves?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, he makes them work. And, you know, he's one of those guys that goes down to the beach with no fins in his board. He looks out and goes, hey, it's a quad day or it's a thruster day.
Okay.
And he's got a couple different sizes of fins in those parameters as well.
Right.
And I get a ton of feedback from, you know, I'm blessed. I got over here and ran into a bunch of really good surfers who started, and kiteboarders. And, you know, I was blessed to be in this funny evolution of surfboards.
Yeah.
From tow to kite to stand up paddle, now foil. You know, that just, I kind of just, like I said, I was blessed just to be in the right place at the right time. But the boards, you know, if the rails are thin enough, that's what's going to hold you in.
Okay.
The fins are going to help too. Another thing I was just talking to someone about is fins are so important in surfboards. I mean, I've been making my own boards for 50 years, and basically every one, I'm still dialing it in with the fins.
That's shocking.
Because I'm chasing a feeling, you know, it's just like, and my boards are all over the spectrum. You know, I mean, mostly now they're getting bigger and bigger, but I'm riding quads. Well, when I was younger and able to surf, I'd get a quad and I'd hit it seemed like the sweet spot shrank, and it could have been my design, could have been my shape. But I'd ride them, and I'd get a couple of great rides, and I'd be paddling back. Oh, I'm back. Okay, get out of my way. And then over the handlebars on the next one. I'd stand up, and it was like, burp, threw out the sea anchor. I just couldn't figure them out. Now, because in my longer boards, I was usually riding a 2+1 or just a thruster. And like the two boards I've got, I just couldn't figure them out. And finally, oh, I put the extra boxes, and we'll just set it up for a quad. First wave, oh, my God, that's what I needed. So I don't know if it's length of board or I don't know.
I know the fact that you're still trying to figure it out feels daunting to me and almost like there's so many variables that I can't even anticipate.
Yeah.
That can we just get me a user-friendly board with a user-friendly set of fins and I'll just stick with that because it's too much information almost, you know. Well, it's kind of like, however, while I want to take that easier path, once I do feel the sensation that you're talking about, I have to chase it. I have to then figure out why those fins and why that shape and then get different sets and try it, you know?
Well, and as a shaper / board builder, you know, when you're finished shaping the board, you sit there, you pull out your 24-inch metal ruler and you mark where the fins go. Well, gosh, every... You know, there's not only the actual placement of the fins, there's the angle, the cant, you know, there's all these other factors. You move it a degree or two here and there, and it's a totally different board. And you've experienced having a board, you know something, and maybe the guy who built it, hey, throw some different fins in it.
Yep.
Shrink the sides, grow the back, do something, and all of a sudden, boom, it works.
Yep.
You know, and so that's, you know, I try to make the platform as... So you're going to float you. You're going to be able to dip it. You're going to, you know, catch waves. You're going to, you know, it's going to glide right through the water. It's not going to be a plow. But the feel of the actual ride, it's also personal.
It is.
You know, because we're all weighting the board's different. Front foot, back foot, balanced, you know, it's all different. I mean, I still find myself scooting up on my boards.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's a thruster or a quad, I move up on them and kind of trim. And you saw what I'm, And I go out on much better days than we did yesterday, where there's real surf.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I'm coming up on 70, I get my ass spanked quite a bit out there now.
Yeah.
You know, but, man, I still love surfing. That's the bottom line.
Well, in regard to board size, I think John redefined a lot of boundaries as he's come into his own. Because, first of all, he's a big kid. He's 6'2", I think.
Yeah.
And he's riding maxed out days at Pipe on a 6'0".
Yeah.
Which is crazy to think about. Kelly certainly pushed board sizes down shorter and shorter as well. But, so you can do it, and Nick is doing it, your son. But he and I were out a day or two ago, and there was one Hawaiian kid, his name's Isaac, that regular
footer. Isaac Stan, yeah.
Yeah. Big boy, riding a big board, and the waves weren't big. But he was riding a board that even looked big for him, like he would ride it in big surf. And he was ripping on that thing. I was like, I saw him paddling by, and I'm like, oh, that board's way too big. It must be the only board that he has available right now, and he just brought it out on a smaller day. But he would have ridden something else had he had the choice. No. He got into wave. He got shoulder-high waves and would just do the most drawn-out turns and, like, tons of power and throw absolute buckets of spray. And then it made me rethink my decision, where it's like, oh, even though I am surfing this board out here to my ability level, I would like to surf like that. I would like to at least try that, what he's doing.
And you know, I know I've known Isaac since he was a little kid. When you ride a bigger board, it allows you to push him harder. That's what I always thought is, you know, if you've got the right board under your feet, you can push that bottom turn as hard as you want, or that the big wrapping cutback, you know, you may not be a quick snap, but you're carving on the rail, and you can lay that thing in as hard as you want, and you know it's going to hold.
Yep. And he was doing it.
Yeah.
He rips.
Yeah. Now, he's a great surfer.
Yeah.
I think he works at Honolulu Surf Company.
Yeah.
And then I think he's got his own surf school now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he had that Honolulu Surf Co. sticker on his board. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the construction of the board that you built for me. Break it down. What is it?
Well, that's one of our Maui Leaf Light series, and it's a new. That has nothing to do with the designs. It has to do with the actual materials, the construction of the boards. And we're either using the U.S. solar made blanks and/or some the Marco recycled, but mostly we're doing plant-based epoxy, the Entropy resins, which are, I find, really nice to work with.
Oh, okay. Good.
And they have three different clarities. You know, if you're doing color work, you can use the higher plant content resin, which is a little brownish, greenish brown. Very, you know, just a light tint. Or you can do clear, or then there's bright. I'm pretty sure we did your board out of bright because it pops pretty good. And then we're using hemp and flax fabrics in the lamination. And I got to give all of that to Nick. You know, he stayed in school, got himself a sustainable science business degree at UH, and he started doing research on stuff. And, you know, he was interested in the styro epoxy because when Clark Foam closed in 2006, because I had all that sailboard knowledge under my belt, that we just went straight to styro epoxy. You know, I was blessed. I got a, you know, 30 or 40 blanks from Ted Wilson over on Oahu, so of the Clark, and when that was all folding up. But just, and so Nick's only been riding the styro epoxy since 2006. You know, I've made him a couple of poly boards. He goes, I can't ride. This isn't, it's a, back to the feel.
Yeah.
He seems to like the little bit stiffer, little, you know, tinnier feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
But he started doing research on the materials. And, you know, we're importing the cloth, some of it from Australia, some of it from China, you know, organic hemp. And the blanks come from the West Coast. And we're just trying to do something not only different, but, you know, I think, and we're trying to do what's right. You know, I've never, and I'm not, I don't say I've never had aspirations to build a million boards. I want to build good boards. Yeah. And I want to build boards that kind of make a difference. And I think this whole new construction theory that we're working on, it's taken off. You know, people come in to order a board, they're conscious of what they're riding. They know. And they say, well, check this out. Here's this one. It's a little more Earth user friendly. It's got some better materials in it. They're a little more expensive, but you know, it's also just turned into 40-45% of the business. We're doing a lot of that stuff, and I love it. I like change. You know, I think one of the reasons I actually moved to Maui is I came over to visit some of the old friends from Russell Surfboards who were over here building sailboards. And I was doing 30, you know, 5'10 to 6'2 squash tail thrusters a week when I had my little California business going. And we were doing well. You know, things were good. But I was just burning out on this. Just, you know, when someone would order a longboard, I'd go, oh, my God, something different. Came over here, kind of did some sailboards on a working vacation, kind of went home with some money. Well, okay, I could do that, you know. And I always liked Hawaii. Lived here in the late 60s, early 70s, and kind of always had this little hook in me somewhere. And I just kind of made a corporate decision. Let's just go. Roll with it. And that was a good decision.
Yeah.
You know, the kids, both son and daughter, dad thanks, you know.
Yeah.
It was a good place for them to grow up. They still have all their original friends that they went to kindergarten with.
Right.
You know, it's a super tight community, family-oriented community, which I think is great.
Well, in regard to building more kind of responsible surfboards, in California, we're intellectually aware that that's the correct thing to do. But once things leave the factory, we never see them again.
Yeah.
And it doesn't affect our daily life. And so it's out of sight, out of mind. I feel like here, it's kind of a petri dish. And it's
exactly.
you see where things go. Yeah. You see the direct effect of waste and how you can actually change the course of things.
Yeah.
So I think, I don't know.
No, there's and waste is a huge part of it. You know, the whole surfboard set. Surfboard, sailboard industry, when they're bringing in those 12-foot by 4-foot by 3-foot blocks of foam.
Yes.
And they're hot wiring out profiles of blanks. You do one of those, it's a dumpster full of scrap.
They don't recycle that stuff?
No. That's something that Nick is working on right now with this guy Eddie and another friend of ours, Pete Sullivan, who's opening a big recycling center in the middle of the island.
Okay.
But there's no infrastructure for it yet.
Right.
You know, and it's coming from everything from food being brought in styrofoam containers that they don't send back on the plane or the boat. They throw them in the landfill.
Right.
And a whole other thing, a realization I came to, and I'm sure it's not just me, but when we moved here, the landfill was a hole in the ground about 200 feet deep. Guess what? It's about a 400-foot high mountain now.
Really?
Yeah. It's filled up. And surfboards, foam, styrofoam,
right.
You know, trash, all the rest of it, construction materials. You look out there and went, oh my God, you know, it's incredible. And it's a small island.
Yeah.
You know, that's a whole nother, you know, there's surfboards are being overbuilt here. You know, it is a small island. I mean, yeah, if you want to do, you could do 10 a week if you were really hustling, but there's just not the clientele for it.
Yeah.
There's just not the clientele.
Yeah. So, I don't know if we've even mentioned in the last 20 minutes, but Nick is your son, and he's got a bachelor's degree, and I think it's environmental.
It's actually sustainable business, sustainable science business.
Got it.
That's the degree.
But he also works for you. He glasses.
He's actually glassing all the leaf lights now.
Okay.
And doing a really, he's probably more meticulous than me. He's up there, and he's getting out every little air bubble, and my poor old eyes don't see that good even with the glasses on.
Sure.
But I'm stoked that he's in there. It gives me a chance to stay closer to him. You know, my daughter has lived in California for 14 years and she just moved home. So we've got our family kind of back together.
Well, you know. I've been talking to Nick. We've been surfing together in the mornings, and he asked me the other day, he's like, what's your understanding of this kind of sustainability conversation? And I'm like, dude, I have no understanding of it. And furthermore, even the experts in the surf space, I feel like I've never seen any real comprehensive longitudinal studies on any of these things that we're discussing. I know they exist outside of the surf space. So I'm apprehensive to start having those conversations on air until I get the right people. Like, sure. Nick would be the right guy, you know? There's different... But I want to devote maybe a series or just kind of an ongoing theme that we touch on about this stuff. And it's okay that there's not been a comprehensive study, but let's now start working towards that and having those conversations, because I think there is a lot of misinformation. So Nick is going to kind of help coach me along the way. But where do you see being the biggest kind of contributing factor in your business in surfboard manufacturing? What is the biggest culprit for doing harm to the environment? I know that EPS can be recycled, but as you said, they're not actually recycling it here on the island. Are there solutions for polyurethane offcuts and dust? What about cloth? What about resins?
I want to say there are, but I'm not. I don't have the power to make those kind of decisions, so to speak. Our biggest thing is always waste. We try to, you know, use all the closest tolerance. We are working towards getting this a styrofoam recycling machine here. But that being said, we're still. I think what we're doing is, because we're small enough that our amount of waste is maybe less, you know, let's say much less than a shop doing 20 boards a week or a shop doing 200 boards a week. At 200 boards a week, that doesn't matter how sustainable it is, you are generating a large amount of waste. And we're guilty as charged. Ours is just at a smaller level. Hopefully that'll be, balance out with the size of the island.
Right.
The cloth offcuts, the U.S. blank cutoffs, all that stuff is not, there's no place to recycle it.
Right.
I mean, I give some to the guy next door who has the ding repair shop and he uses it up. But other than that, it goes into the landfill.
I think people just being cognizant, board builders being cognizant of, like you said, ordering the right blank, the close tolerance blanks, you're not. Because, I mean, the difference between a blank that is a good fit versus the closest tolerance could be three times the amount of waste.
Sure.
It looks close,
yeah,
but it's still three times the amount of waste. So making little decisions like that and being cognizant, and then, of course, repurposing wood offcuts, send it to the longboard builder down the street who wants it for tail blocks or fins or something like that. Yeah. Those little decisions, I think, can do a lot to reduce waste. I actually got an email this morning from an environmental lawyer who was referencing the Dave Parmenter series that I've been doing, and we've been talking about similar things and environmental impact and all that sort of stuff. And she goes, while it's undeniable that resin and fiberglass and foam dust is detrimental to the environment, a surfboard that most people use for years is hardly contributing to any environmental problems. Surfers do so many environmentally unfriendly things that a surfboard probably has the smallest impact of all. Consider that most surfers get in their car to drive to a surf spot. Of course, you know about the impact of the car burning fuel, but have you thought about the manufacturing of the car? Metal forging, including metal forgers in California, a huge contributor of toxic metals into stormwater runoffs and makes river toxic waste dumps for habitat. The tires and brake pads shed zinc, also a toxic metal. The breakfast burrito filled with bacon and chorizo is likely from pork raised in a concentrated animal feeding operation, the biggest contributors on the planet to greenhouse gases. We can get into the impacts of getting on a plane and taking an international surf trip, but you probably get the point. So I thought that was all kind of interesting, too.
Very well put, though. And that's where other people have way more expertise.
Nick does.
Yes.
That's what he studied.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you talk to him, it's all of a sudden he goes, I just sit there, it's going right over my head, kid.
You know, it doesn't go over my head so much as it feels insurmountable. Like reading her email, it's like, so I'm not supposed to drive my car anymore? I'm not supposed to get on a plane? Like, I'm simply not going to do that.
Yeah.
Or I am going to do those things. So how about give me some realistic ways that I can reduce?
Yeah, well, also, hey, let's all have electric cars.
Which there's a start. I do, yeah.
I don't, but I think everything has to start with a start. little steps, you know, and have the powers that be want to go with it instead of, and this is just a blank, say big oil. Hey, we want to keep putting gas in those cars. You know, I've said for years, hey, oil is a lubricant. It should just be used to, you know, oil the wheels. Electric cars, everyone should have one.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's been the first electric cars were in the 70s, and they worked great, and then they shot it all down.
Because they're trying to develop this thing against big
money interest. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So in regard to the Maui Leaf Light, customer can come into your shop and order a board in traditional construction or the Maui Leaf Light construction.
Correct.
And how much is the added cost for them? And is the market open to that? Are they accepting of it?
You know, as much as I worried about that, the people that want them, they don't mind. And it's an extra $125,
okay,
which is not that much. Some of the blanks we're bringing in, because there's no distributor here for them, that cost me twice what they usually cost.
And
at first, with the shipping and all, at first, you know, we were bringing the Entropy resin in because nobody had it. You know, we finally convinced Fiberglass Hawaii to start carrying it. But we seem to be the only ones buying it, which is fine.
Sure.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
So yeah, the added cost and building an epoxy board the way we do it, they're a bit more labor intensive.
Okay.
You know, after I'm done shaping, we squeegee on a layer of epoxy with some thickener in it. Let that kick, do the other side, and put the future boxes in, or the FCS2, whichever, and then do the same thing, and then lightly sand it, and then at that point, you could either airbrush it or start laminating. So there's just more steps, and, you know, sanding between the coats is a kind of a must with epoxy, even because once it gets hard, there's no physical bond. There's just a chemical bond where you have to scrape it with some 60 grit just to get, so it'll have something to grab onto. So that's it's just a matter of, it's a business that's supposed to make money. I as much as I want to help everybody, and I figure I'm doing my job shaping them the best board I possibly can.
One conversation I want to have with you that has a lot of different branches to it is, has being based on Maui helped or hindered your career? Because It's fast. This is so idyllic. I never want to leave. I'm sure you don't want to leave. And in one aspect is, well, windsurfers come here, so that's a big avenue that you can pursue for business. But getting boards off of here is also difficult. So, I mean, if somebody in California or Florida or elsewhere in the world wants to order a board from you, that creates an element.
It's an extra cost.
Okay.
And we ship. I've been shipping worldwide since I got here. I mean, I've sent boards to England, Israel. It's all doable. It's just a matter of money.
What's your initial response to has being based on Maui been beneficial or?
It's been beneficial for me.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I love it here. I like the climate. I love the greenery. Once I gave up my aspiration, and I don't even know if I ever had an aspiration to be, Rusty or Al Merrick, just to name some of the big guys. I think I had an aversion to when things go wrong in a business that you have to let people go, lay people off. They're relying on you. And maybe I just didn't want that stress. So over here with, my new business plan is we do 5 or 6 boards a week. We keep it all in-house. There's, myself. I have a wonderful young lady that airbrushes and does hot coating and puts in fin systems. And my son. It's just the three of us. And I'm able to control the time frame of the boards as well. There was a time when I was running, two boards. I was shaping 10 boards a week. And I was putting 2 a day in a glass shop. And they did great work. But after 5 years, I would have thought I'd be getting 2 boards out every day. But they get lost in the mix. So I've got, all of a sudden, I got 20 boards over there. And I'm not getting any of them out. In a small business, you need income like coming in daily.
Absolutely.
Here especially. Because it's expensive. I got to make $300 to $500 a day here to make ends meet. And to take that odd surf trip. It's a small island and I've been able to make it. And I like it here. I wouldn't really change too much. I don't want to build more boards. But with what we're doing now, we're making boards that matter. And I think we're kind of planting a seed for the future board builders.
Good. Let's get into your history a little bit. I know, so I live in Huntington Beach. I have for 10 years. That's your old stomping grounds.
Yeah, I was actually, born in L.A. My parents moved to Downey in 1955 and opened the restaurant, Timpone's Italian Cuisine.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they ended up with 4 restaurants, and that's kind of where I just grew up, bussing tables, washing dishes. Played baseball, football, the typical, because we lived in La Mirada. That's where we ended up. We moved to Downey from East L.A. to Downey, then to La Mirada.
Which is where my mom lives currently.
Yeah.
She's been there. She works for the school district. She's been there my whole life.
There you go. Yeah, and that was a fun place. Greg Martz and I were high school surf mates.
That's right.
And there was, it's funny, a lot of the inland guys turned out, Stussy. One of my oldest friends, we shaped together at Russell's. But I met him the week I moved back from Hawaii to California, and we just became surf buddies.
Yeah.
But he was from Garden Grove, and he just was lucky enough to have Ole as his woodshop teacher at was it Rancho High School? I don't remember the exact name.
Yeah.
But a lot of the inland guys, I think because we didn't have the beach right outside of our front doorstep, we chased it harder.
Yep.
I mean, when I first got the surfing bug, it was just like, oh my God, that's all I wanted to do. I mean, when I was 16, I was playing Colt League baseball for the La Mirada Giants. And, man, I got that car, had the surfboard in the back, drove up to practice. The coach, hey, nice car, Tim Pony. Had the uniform all washed and pressed. Here, coach, I'm done. I just drove away. It was from, and see, from there, Trestles was like 45 minutes away.
Yep.
Rincon, an hour or so away. It was very centrally located. The 5 freeway was right, a couple miles away, just on the other side of Knott's Berry Farm.
Yep.
So it was a pretty neat place to grow up.
Yeah. What was your first trip to Hawaii then?
It would have been 1968.
Okay.
I came, some friends were already here, over on, just on Oahu, just in Waikiki, they called it the jungle, which was just like a couple blocks back from the Duke Kahanamoku statue. There was tons of little cheap rental places. And was there for a few months, and then you know, moved back to Cali, started college like all good young men should do, and failed. Got drafted, ran for it.
Oh, really?
Got on a plane with $75 in my pocket and a surfboard and a blank, and flew over to Honolulu, got a job building boats. And the guy at the boat shop said, hey, you can build all the surfboards you want with the boat materials.
Wow.
So it was, I mean, and I wasn't building a lot of boards. That was just for myself.
Yeah.
You know, the reason I started building boards was because you couldn't go down to the shops and buy what was current. I mean, at that 67, 68, the designs were changing and shrinking so fast. I mean, I think I did two strip downs of strip downs.
Wow.
You know, I mean, they'd start off at 9 feet, go to 8 feet, go to 7 feet, you know, and they just got thinner and narrower. But that's what the designs were doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, in Hawaii, and at the boat shop, it was right near the old Surfline Hawaii shop on P'i Koi, right across the street from Ala Moana Center. So we were in the back lot there. And it was, you know, Joe Quigg was building Joey Cabell, a 50-foot catamaran right next door to us.
Wow.
And we were building 27 and 33-foot fishing boats.
Wow.
But, and it was just a quick jump over the fence and run to Ala Moana State Park for big rights every evening after work just to wash the fiberglass and the resin off. But it just, you know, I didn't, it was never a grand plan. Stuff just kind of fell into place. And the boat job went for 4 years. And I made some pretty good money. I was able to buy a piece of property in Ortega. I'm pointing over there. I'm in Maui. You know, up Ortega Highway, up on the top place called Rancho Carrillo.
Back in Southern California.
Yes. My mom and my dad and my uncle, Edmund, had bought this 6-acre property up there, and my Uncle Edmund wanted out of the deal. And because I lived so frugally, and I actually made good money building boats, I had, you know, 20 grand in the bank. So I just, here's 15 of it, and I owned myself a piece of property. Well, that 15 turned to like 80 when we sold it. So, and then I bought my first house in Huntington. Back lot on that was all my mom. You know, in our whole Timpone group, she was always the brains of the family.
Yeah.
Brilliant woman. Lived to be, you know, died at 97. You know, not that part of it wasn't that pretty, but she really helped me. I still feel her hand on my shoulder sometimes.
What happened to their restaurants? Did they do that for their entire career?
No, well, they did. They started selling off the restaurants. It was a pretty big family operation. So my Aunt Rosalind and her husband were running one on in Anaheim. Oh, God, the name of the street is escaping me. But it was one of the main drags in Anaheim heading towards the beach. Like, anyway, I'll remember it when it's not pertinent. And there was one in Los Alamitos.
Yep.
And there was one, they opened a little deli right there at La Mirada at, you know, it was Highway 39 and Lutweiler Street, which turned into La Mirada Boulevard. There was I want to say one of the original Kmarts. They had a little Timpone's right next to that. But they started selling those off.
Oh, okay, cool.
And Dad went to work for a big ravioli company as a delivery driver. You know, they were sick of having their own business. And my mom went into real estate, and she absolutely killed it.
Good.
So when the time came for me to buy that first house, she had it all picked out.
Sure.
She kind of did all the footwork, and I just had to, like, fork over the money.
Good.
And houses back then, what did we pay? $85,000 for a house in Huntington?
That's now, I mean, well more than 10 times that.
Oh, yeah.
It's not $800,000 anymore. It's probably over $1 million.
Yeah.
I'm also curious, real quickly, the draft dodge, you could dodge it just by going to Hawaii?
There was a little bit of a method to the madness.
Okay.
There was a method to the madness, and it was really, in my generation, there was a, you know, a lot of guys, we had friends that just signed up and went, joined the Marines. I'm going, you know, they were gung-ho, and then, unfortunately, a lot of them didn't come back, or they came back and they were all screwed up in the head. And that had nothing to do with my reasons for not going. Part of it was I had been in a Catholic military school for 7 years, St. Catherine's Military Academy on Harbor Boulevard in Anaheim. And I knew what the military was all about. And as a youngster who was kind of, I don't want to say I grew up on my own, because my parents were there, but they owned four restaurants. I never saw them. So it was my brother and I kind of raised ourselves. And I was hard-headed enough to go, I don't really feel like taking orders. I don't want to shine my shoes and stand for attention every morning. And, you know, I knew all about guns. I'd been shooting guns since I was in second grade. And I knew what they could do. And it just, you know, I guess I was a peacenik. But the dodging of it was, you go to some place where there's a much smaller draft board. And I had been through the draft board on 9th Street in L.A. Look at the movie Big Wednesday. And that's, honest to God, that's pretty much what it was like. Where you go down there and it was like every... You saw guys that you hadn't seen since high school. You saw everyone was there. Follow the yellow line. Go upstairs. Turn left. You know, turn left and cough. You know, you get the whole... So I've been through that. It was 1A. And... But I was...
Meaning you were the first priority.
Yes. I was totally draftable. And it only took from the time I passed that till the time the induction papers came was maybe 4 weeks. And it was just like, you know what? I'm out of here. And, you know, Dad supported me. He gave me $150, which back then, one-way ticket from L.A. to Honolulu was $75. And I had $75 in my pocket. But what I did is, in Honolulu, if you were you had to be a little bit different. So, say you, I had one guy. He drank 2 quarts of prune juice before he went down for his physical. Walked in and pooped himself. And they just told him to beat it. He goes, oh, when I get excited, I can't control myself. Well, you ain't going to be shooting a gun, you know?
Yeah.
So, anyway, I just took a different path and was underweight, believe it or not. I got in there, and I want to say I weighed about 115 by the time I got in there, and they wouldn't take me. I had to force the issue a little bit.
But, sure.
But it was
interesting.
It wasn't one of my shining moments. You know, as a young person, you make decisions. I was 19, 18 or 19 years old. Yeah. And that, to me now, I was a kid. I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
Yeah, definitely. At 19.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, so you make these decisions and you think it's all cool. And then all of a sudden, you know, the FBI's knocking at your door out at Rocky Point and dragging you into a car and taking you down to Fort DeRussy. Okay, here he is, Jeff Dimponi, the famous draft dodger. Put him on the front lines.
Did that happen?
It did.
Really?
Yeah.
So when they said put him on the front lines,
well,
did you get shipped out?
No.
Oh, okay.
You got to remember, pre-computer.
Okay.
So the people at the draft board and the FBI, they were not communicating. And there was a whole community of guys out on the North Shore back then doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Well, we don't know who this guy is. We'll, you know, take him over to the federal pen, and it'll take 3 to 4 months to get his records transferred from California, snail mail. Okay, so we went over there. They wouldn't take me because they were full. So they had to. I signed a paper and said, okay, if we have to come back and get you again, you don't get to go in the Army anymore. You just go to prison for 5 years, federal prison for five years. So I signed the paper and just kind of went back to doing my thing, not thinking about it, you know, going to work, building the boats, surfing. You know, we basically, our work schedule was Friday afternoon, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and we'd surf Monday through Friday. And it was a great gig, and I rode a lot of waves. At one point, we actually even moved to Kauai, lived in a camper truck, and I was up there for a couple of years, which was, back then, it was super. I mean, we got there, the locals were happy to see us because it was somebody else to surf with.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. Anyway, I failed the physical and just kind of danced out, and that part wasn't as easy as I would have liked, but I did it. And it allowed me to pursue the boat building thing, which I learned a lot about fiberglass and resin. And then after that, building surfboards was like, oh, yawn. It was pretty easy.
Sure.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Yeah. That is a fascinating story. It's a fascinating time in history, by the way.
Well, it was, you know. And like I said, I have mixed feelings about the whole thing, but I definitely don't have any mixed feelings about a draft. It doesn't belong in our society.
Yeah. I'm glad I didn't have to live through any of those. I mean, those are real adult decisions.
Yeah, and kids were having to make it. And then, you know, the typical thought line was that if they didn't get you between, let's say, you were 18 and 21, they didn't want you anymore because it was getting too hard to mold you into what they wanted to mold you into. So, yeah.
It sounds so diabolical when you put it that way, you know?
Yeah, it's just weird, you know? It's a mindset, you know? I mean, and like I said, I'm as patriotic as the next guy.
Yeah, yeah, that has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, this was just, and it's like it was a decision that I made, be it right, be it wrong, here I am.
So what year was it that you said that was the late 60s?
Yes.
So were guys already, I mean, they were surfing pipe. The North Shore was in full swing at that point.
Yes, it was.
Who were the main board builders? Who were you taking cues from at that point? You were just building your own boards, you said?
Yeah, yeah. No, basically, we lived right at Rocky Point. Tiger Aspare and Barry Kanayapuni were the two Hawaiian guys, and they were at the time into riding these super narrow, like 14, 16-inch wide boards, and I loved the way those guys surfed. Not that I was anywhere near them. But I started making my boards, you know, 8 foot by 16 inches wide. You know, just these full spears with a little teeny dick fin on it. But, I love Brewer's boards. And I think one of the guys I really respected and loved his stuff was Mike Diffenderfer.
Yep.
He made beautiful boards, beautiful boards. And those are the guys I kind of tried to emulate until these guys I was living with at Rocky Point at the time, they had a friend named Bob McTavish. Showed up at the house and wanted a place to stay for a couple months. So he moved in with us. And the day he got there, he showed up with a blank. And the next day, he hand-sketched an outline on it, shaped it, glassed it. It was a little like a Michael Peterson little egg with a single fin. And he paddled out, and I think it was the best surfing I ever saw in my life.
Really?
Just totally mind-boggling. Like, you know, surfboard-wise, life-changing. So my boards went from long and skinny to boop, right down to short with a round nose, little diamond tail, single fins. But he was doing these turns. You know, those guys were so far ahead of the curve when it came to actual maneuverability on the waves. And McTavish was a little guy. I mean, he's maybe a little over 5 feet tall.
Where was that you saw him surfing?
Right at Rocky Point.
Okay.
Yeah, right there, Rocky Point.
So head high waves, nothing huge.
Yeah, no, it wasn't giant. You know, it was you know, maybe a little overhead, but he was actually coming off the bottom and doing wraparound cutbacks. Maybe, you know, they were going up off the whitewater like they do today, but he was changing direction in ways that, and I was inspired by him, just so happens, from a surf film, and I want to say it was called The Hot Generation. The final sequence in that movie was Nat Young, George Greeno and Bob McTavish surfing Honolulu Bay on those first V-bottoms.
Hmm.
And it was just like, that's how I want to surf. That's what inspired me to start building boards as well.
Fascinating.
But, you know, and when I say building boards, you know, back then there was no YouTube tutorials. You built it start to finish. You know, made your own fin, glassed them in somebody's garage, rough sanded it, and you were out there.
It's funny, even you just saying that you traveled to the U.S. or from the U.S. to Hawaii with the blank, and Bob McTavish showed up with a blank.
Yeah.
Because you don't know if you can get supply once you get to your destination.
No.
But you do know that you're going to want a board for a certain type of wave in that area.
Yeah.
So you got to bring your materials with you just so you can make the board.
Yeah, I mean,
that's fascinating.
I had the blank, and I threw my existing 7.2 with a glass on fin on top of it, might have wrapped a blanket around it with some duct tape or something, or some rope, gave it to the airport guys, and it showed up in one piece.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Ted Wilson earlier. His business is Fiberglass Hawaii. I know they've been in business since 1966.
Yes.
So once you landed, did they have blanks available?
Oh, no. Blanks were not part of the Fiberglass Hawaii thing.
They were just supplying the boat building industry?
Well, and I'm sure they were supplying the surfboard industry as well, but they were not supplying blanks.
Got it.
You know, when I first met Ted, he was before he actually bought Fiberglass Hawaii.
Oh, okay.
He was blowing foam right near where the boat shop was. And I used to go up there and I'd buy a blank that didn't fill up the mold. The nose is missing. A reject blank, maybe $3 or $5. And that was what I was shaping my first boards out of. When it was easy to do those little short, stumpy ones.
Right, because nobody else probably wanted them.
Well, no, they were just going to get thrown away.
Yeah.
So for me, it was easy, and I could just, it was maybe 150 feet to walk across the alley, and there was Ted.
How long was he blowing blanks, and what was the name of that blank company?
I want to say he was working with Grubby Clark. But it wasn't Clark Foam. It wasn't anything. I just saw stuff going in and out of there because I was worked right across the alley.
That's a footnote in the pages of surf history. I mean, I've never heard a name associated with that. Wilson Foam? I mean, what? It was just,
like I said,
for a short period of time?
No, obviously it was a very short period of time because it didn't go.
Yeah.
He was having problems. And I don't know if it could have been the humidity that was different from California. Maybe he was using an Australian formula. You know, Ted knew all the guys in Australia that were making foam and building boards as well.
But I think that's what people don't realize is that is such a, sensitive kind of chemical process.
Oh, yeah.
That it's like, it's not easy. And even the people who've been doing it forever still are making adjustments based on what you said, humidity and environment and all that sort of stuff.
It's just like, glassing a board. Sometimes I go up into my little glassing area and it's just like, dude, it's hot. You know, I better just use like a teeny little bit of catalyst. Just kind of wave the catalyst jug over the resin and it's still going off hot.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. Well, then, how did you find yourself in Maui?
Well, moved after the whole... You know, when the boat shop went under and my two partners, one guy actually was a South African, he got deported for working in the U.S. And my other friend, Kirk Pearson, who was a high school surf mate, he hopped on a boat and crewed down to Tahiti and never came back. He met a girl, had a few kids, and just stayed down there. And it was like, oh, I wanted to stay, but I knew I was just going to be a casualty of the not only the drug generation, but the whole scene. You know, it was wild. I mean, the North Shore especially, and in Kauai, you could be in the wrong place at the wrong time and get your ass just lit up. I mean, I got punched out a couple times there. Just, hey, you look like you want to fight. No, boom. You know, you just
really?
Be getting it. Oh, yeah. But it was just the times. And, you know, the surf was so good and there was nobody there. It was just like you look past it.
In Kauai?
Yeah. I mean, I was another time blessed to be up there. We lived in a... We had a four-door Air Force surplus pickup truck. We built a camper shell over the whole thing, shipped it over there, and just moved in. And we did the same thing. Back then, inter-island flights were $10 each
week. Wow.
I was making $650 every weekend building a boat. So it was like, that was a no-brainer. And then in Kauai, we were basically vegetarians. Yeah, we'd find an avocado tree dripping. I'd make some tortillas because the pizza guy, I was always in charge of making the tortillas for the burritos or avocado tacos.
Yeah, I mean, you could live off the land there. No
Pretty
problem.
Much. Yeah.
Especially if you fish. Or
we were vegetarian, so we weren't even eating fish.
Interesting.
Anyway, when I moved back, Greg Martz called me up one evening and we connected as soon as I got back. I want to say I shaped a board and took it to the glass shop where he was laminating, which was a place called Surf Glass up in Santa Ana on Hathaway Street. And he laminated it and finished it up for me. And it actually was right outside of there. I met Stussy. Sean, I was sitting there, cross-legged, checking out my new board. And this big old step van pulls up and little kid gets out with punk rock hair going straight up. It was Sean. And he says, hey, nice board. I'm just dropping one off, too. He was kind of, I want to say Sean's about 5 years younger than me, but we were kind of at the same level board building wise. But he was lucky. He had Ole already, mentoring him. Anyway, I got hired as the sander at Surf Glass. And, minimum, I sanded 20 boards a day there, minimum. I think my world record for me was like 32 in one day.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, but they were easy. They're all those Nuevas with the fin box and the ones with the eagle on them. What were they called? Anyway, they had a name. But, man, I did 20 of those every day. And Mel Ross was laminating and Greg Martz was laminating. And they had, I'm sure there was people coming in a hot coat and it was just a nonstop. And I was lucky enough to land that job, worked there all summer. And then the business was a little more seasonal back then. So it started to slow down in the wintertime. So they put me to work down at their little surf shop, which was right across from the north side of the pier. You know, there was Wind and Sea. And across 6th Street, there was a place they called it 6th Street Marina. And we sold, at that same glass shop, they built the first Prindle Cats. Jeff Prindle and Sterling Santley, the two owners, built the molds and everything in there. So I was selling catamarans, and they had a shop full of surfboards called Pure Joy. And that was, you know, that was a place to live. I mean, I lived there, worked there. It was, and surfed every morning. North Side was firing. And then one day Russ pulls up, dude, I need a sander, you know, desperately. My guy got arrested. He's gone. And, I was there the next day. Cause at that time working for Russell was, they were building the best boards in Orange County. I mean, there was guys building boards up and down the coast, but I want to say we had the style part of it dicked.
Okay.
You know, there was no airbrushing. All the colors were done in the laminations, you know, all resin pin lines, all, you know, they were just stylish boards and lots of nose and tail blocks. Same glass on fin as the nose and the tail blocks.
Sure.
Just real matte, you know, real, like I said, stylish stuff.
Yeah.
You know, as Russ used to say, one quote from Russell, we build Cadillacs here.
Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
So Maui.
Oh, yeah. Spent my 8 years at Russell's, opened Tim Pony's in 1980, right there in Huntington, across from one of Russ's last shops up on Slater. And started coming over for visits to see some friends that had worked at Russell's that were over here building sailboards. And they convinced me one time to bring my tools, and I made enough money to kind of plant that little light bulb. Hey, maybe we could go over there and do something different. And like I said, I always liked Hawaii. So I just made a corporate decision and told the little woman, hey, we're moving.
And what was it about Maui as opposed to you had already spent time on Oahu and Kauai, and I would feel like it would feel safer to go to somewhere that you knew and had roots.
Very true. But I knew I didn't want to go to Oahu. It was already overbooked.
It was?
Yeah. And when I got – we went to Kauai first and were only up there for a little while when I realized that the welcome wagon wasn't out. In Kauai, it was and it was probably something I was never aware of. You know, each island has its own vibe.
Of course, yeah.
And the vibe just was not there anymore. I still go up there a couple times a year just to surf. I mean, I'll go surf. I love surfing Hanalei. And there's some places on the west side that are just fabulous. And I can still go out there and get waves. But I knew I could come over here and land and find work. And so we showed up. I was the roving shaper. I went from Angulo to Sailboards Maui to High Tech. I was doing, you know, 10 boards a week, and they paid $1.25 a board. And we rented a place, and away we went.
Yeah.
And, you know, went into partnerships with one of the sailboard guys, and that only lasted about a year. It kind of went south. But I ended up with a glass shop, and started glassing all these boards. No, it was a good move.
So I mentioned this to you previously, but my first exposure to you was actually twofold. I can't remember which one came first, but it was seeing Rush Randall doing a backflip on a board that had your logo on it on Maui in a magazine. And I was just blown away. It was like I was really new into surfing, and I'm like, well, there's a backflip. That's better.
Yeah.
That's different. And then I think – so that must have been first because I was familiar with the logo. And then a friend of mine in high school had a board, a Timpony short board. And so I traded him. I think, you know, it's like you ride a board for a while, you get the feel for it, and you just want something new.
You're looking to move on, yeah.
Yeah, and I had a board that he was interested in, so we just swapped. And then rode that Timpony. And it was of the, you know, super thin, super rockered out, mid-90s, high performance, very thin shortboard thruster era, which didn't do me any favors at all. It's like I was learning to surf. Mm-hmm. So
you had the exact opposite of what you needed.
Totally. Just sitting on it was problematic. You know, I'm like buried up to my chest in water, yeah. Like trying to catch waves and stand up and rip. But anyway, that I think is an interesting little detour in surfing. I mentioned Rush Randall. For people who aren't familiar, he was strapped in.
Can you walk me through that era? That was how the whole tow-in thing started.
And so the tow-in thing wasn't into big waves. They were towing him into.
Yeah, you know, it actually, there was no towing. A few of the guys came to me because their shapers wouldn't put foot strap inserts into their surfboards. These guys were professional. Rush was a professional windsurfer. Mark Angulo, Dave Kalama, they were all professional windsurfers. They were used to the foot straps. Connected surfing thing. And I kind of went, wow, surfing, snowboarding, connected. Rubber. I kind of saw the, oh, that makes sense. They were paddling into waves, standing up, plugging their feet into the straps, and they get a couple turns and boom, they do a flip or do a big aerial. Like one of my original business cards, I had a picture of Mark Angulo just, he's like flying through the air. You can barely see the wave way down there, but he's just down the line going over a section. Wow. But with the foot straps.
Wow.
And it just made sense.
I did not know that they were paddling into those waves.
Yeah. I mean, the first, and this is another, just a little insight into the whole thing. The first time I saw any of it, I was driving, and this is when I had my shop in Kahului. I lived in Haiku, actually on the same street that the shop's on West Kuiaha. We lived, had rented a place in the back there right on the gulch. Anyway, I was driving, coming back from town or the shop, because the shop was downtown at the time, and I pulled over because I saw one guy out at Hokipa, and it happened to be Laird. And he, back when he was shortboarding, he had booties with Velcro and Velcro pads on the deck of his board. And he would just, he'd take off, he'd stick his feet down. We were stuck. But he'd, boom, he was doing these big trying stuff. And he fell up, but also, boom, he landed a couple of things. And that was the first connected surfing I saw.
What a freak.
Yeah. And he was like, he was ahead of the pack that was already chasing him down. But they formed a group called the Strapped Crew.
Yeah.
And they started making those radical attitude, which is, it was just fun. It was fun. But it, and then I want to say Buzzy towed Laird into a wave at Backdoor on Oahu. No, it wasn't Backdoor. It was Backyards, outside Sunset. And there's a, and Laird was riding, I want to say he was riding one of his stepdad Billy's boards. It was like a 10-foot balsa gun. And that's how the tow-in thing started. You know, I want to say they used a Zodiac or something.
Yeah.
And that's what they started there and then went to you know, anything they could get and boom, the jet ski. And then it was no Jaws. They started off towing into small waves and kind of built their way up. And then all of a sudden they're at Outer Sprecs, which is one of the outer reef spots here on Maui. It's a 45-minute paddle out, but it's a great wave. And they had helicopter footage, and it was just all time. So they started making their little movies. And I don't remember. I have a picture of Kalama in the shop on one of the original tow boards. And that tow board was probably 7'10 and 15 inches wide. Super concave bottom, like a water ski. But he's dropping into, you know, 20-foot wave and doing a big bottom turn. And that was it. And it was just like, and those guys dominated it out there for years. They had it wrapped up. They've been in it before flotation, you know, it was before anything.
Oh, yeah.
They were just winging it. And thank God none of them perished.
Yeah.
You know,
it's calculated risk, you know?
Total.
They're all complete watermen.
Total. You know, they were the ones that started the whole running underwater with rocks
right.
and doing all the training and stuff. And but that was a fun time. See, and for me, I like the challenge of putting my talent to work doing different stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, you want a stand-up paddleboard? Well, sure. And those all started off with that 12-foot-4 tandem blank that Clark used to make. So, hey, they were limited. We can only make them 25 inches wide. Then we started ordering with extra foam on each side of the strainer. They kept pushing them out, getting them a little thinner, a little more surfy. You know, and I think those guys just started doing it because they wanted to get more waves.
Sure.
You know, they started off with bigger boards, just paddling in. You know, and Laird was a phenomenal longboarder, and Dave too. You know, and the other guys all went in different directions. You know, there was, you know, the original foiling was happening. It was a thing called the air chair.
Oh, yeah.
That had a foil attached, but it was literally like that chair attached to a foil. And yeah. You'd sit there and try. They start doing this dolphining thing, and it's just like, whap, you just get a face plant.
That's crazy. So that, I mean, you mentioned Jaws. Those innovations made Jaws surfable. Because
totally.
Jaws was only accessible via tow.
Yeah. Yeah, at the time, no one imagined that you could paddle into it.
Right.
Which has been totally proven wrong.
Right.
But the boards kept evolving. There was probably a 10-year period there where the boards just evolved and got smaller and heavier. And not you couldn't go much narrower because you needed to have your feet on them.
Yeah.
But I like the challenge of being able to take someone's ideas and put it onto a surfboard. And figure out the fin placement and the cant and the toe and all of the stuff. And most of those boards, we just ran the fins straight.
I mean, that's what's interesting about you talking about the strapped crew or even layered with the Velcro, which is you can't shuffle your feet. I need to shuffle my feet on every wave I'm on, obviously, like all the time.
Yeah.
So it's weird to think that you just commit to it.
And I think and like I said, all those guys were professional athletes, even though that term's way different now.
Yeah.
But they just conquered by, I think, sure strength and will. You know, Laird would plant his feet and just make it happen. Even if he wasn't in the right spot, he would go.
Yeah. Does he still live on the island? I know.
No, I'm pretty sure he lives in Kauai part-time. And I think he lives in
Malibu, Cave area. Yeah. I knew that. I didn't know where his home was on the islands.
I want to say he sold his place here and he's got a place over there.
Okay. It's become, I mean, it's funny to think, I mean, lots of celebrities now and high profile people have homes here.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's kind of interesting how it's like still small town feel and you probably see everybody throughout the course of the year at
Mata Foods, the health food store in Bahia.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
That's still kind of got that small town feel to it. The only thing that's really changed is the amount of traffic.
Right. You
know, I mean, that there was never traffic here before, and now it's just like okay, it's a part of the growth, you know, and it's tourism.
Yeah.
And there's more people living here.
So I actually was curious about Jaws. How do you think Jaws positively or negatively affected the local A, surf community, and B, economy?
I think it's helped.
You think so?
Oh, totally. Because they have big contests there. It does bring in people. You know, when Jaws is breaking, it's pandemonium down there. There's guys running tours. They'll charge you $10 for a ride in and a ride out. There's people making food down there. It started off, some guy had to ride it. Because there's 300-400 people on the bluff. Those are all tourists. They hear Jaws is up there driving. It's a traffic jam on the Hana Highway. But it started off with the guy, he just like went home one night and froze a bunch of lemonade and put sticks in it and was down there selling them.
Yeah.
And it just blew up from there.
Good. I mean, because there's no hotels.
No.
There's no hotels. There's very few restaurants.
Yeah, no, this is the North Shore has not changed much at all.
I guess,
I stopped going down there, and I used to go down there a lot. But I want to say it was after Mark Fu died, and I didn't know Mr. Fu. But I also realized, you know something? I got my friends are out there. I don't want to watch one of them not come up or get thrown onto the rocks or... You know, it was just kind of like, you know, I can watch on the video, I can see pictures, that's enough.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is a perfect segue to my next kind of line of wrap-up questions, which is, what do you actually watch? What do you follow? At this point, do you, in terms of surf media, are you watching the WSL events and keeping track? Are you subscribing to magazines? Where do you get your surf content?
You know what? I do watch the WSL stuff because I find it super fascinating. And the surfers are incredible athletes. When I was their age, I couldn't have imagined what they're actually doing.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to draw pictures about being in the barrel, or just, you know, mostly pictures of just waves, because we had these fantasies. Well, now Kelly's made the perfect wave. I love the way all Gabriel Medina is incredible. I mean, I look at the way he surfs. He's like, oh my God, the guy's like a from another planet.
It's like a robot.
Yeah,
just doesn't fall. Does what he wants to do.
Yeah, and what he does when he wants to do, or when he does what he wants to do, is unbelievable.
Yeah.
So I love watching that. I subscribe to the Surfer's Journal, and it seems like it's gone through some changes. And I can honestly say that I really like the older incarnation because they had more vintage stuff. Maybe. It's my age, you know, but the stories of the guys that were before me, I always found fascinating. You know, the guys diving for lobster and abalones off of Laguna, and they said it was just covered, you know, stuff like that. Those guys were real watermen. And not that the surfers today aren't, but it's just different. You know, it's gotten modern. But other than that, I listen to the podcast as much as I can. Sometimes as usual, I get home and I'm doing stuff. I forget to download because I can't download at the shop. I got to do it at the house with the Wi-Fi. It's all technical stuff.
Yeah. Are you on Instagram? You have an Instagram account.
We do. I do not pursue it.
You don't look at it?
I get all the information from my son. He does all of the social media stuff.
Yeah.
And we sit there almost every morning and go over what he's posted, what people are saying. He is that's kind of his job.
Yeah.
For me, it was like I did Facebook for years, but at the end, it was just like I'd find myself sitting there, and all of a sudden, 3 hours went by.
I know.
And I was talking to old friends from high school or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
That crap, I got to make some money.
Yeah. No, that's a huge problem for me, too, is the amount of time that it occupies.
Yeah.
It's beneficial for business to be able to promote your things, but I would think that you would get some of what you were just saying, Surfer's Journal maybe used to provide or whatever. I think you would get some of that out of Instagram. It's interesting to just see. You can see what Bob McTavish is up to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like, no, Nick and I are going to, he's been threatening to set my own, just a personal Instagram, because you don't have to talk to anybody. This is just so you can look and see what's going on.
Yeah.
And as you will find out being around me, I love to talk. You know, I'm a pretty good talker. So that's why when I get on those things, it's like, oh boy, here we go. It's
you got to make it work for you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like all of technology is created with the kind of promise of synthesizing your life and maximizing efficiency and all that sort of stuff. But left to our own devices,
we'll try to over maximize.
Totally. Totally. This morning, Brittany caught a gecko in our bedroom and ran it out the front door. I opened the door and she dumped it out in the bushes. And I posted the video of it on Instagram. My dad was sitting right where you're sitting. We did it right behind him, right there while he's just reading the morning paper on his iPad. And then I sit down on the sofa. He pulls up Instagram and goes, "Hey, I saw you guys catch that gecko in your bedroom." And I'm like, "Yeah, Dad, it was 5 minutes ago, 3 feet away from you."
Yeah, and you missed it.
It was like the ultimate example.
Now, that's one of the perks of living in Haiku. You get geckos everywhere. You can't keep them out.
They're not a problem, really.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
There's just the rest of it that goes with them.
You know, right.
Centipedes and cockroaches and jungle living at its finest.
But somebody then commented on that Instagram, the gecko actually takes care of those things, right? So you want to leave the gecko so that you don't get the cockroaches.
Yeah. Yeah. The cockroaches always seem to outnumber the geckos.
Oh, really?
I think the geckos cannibalize themselves.
Really? This is a perfect segue back to our, or full circle back to our sustainability conversation. Leave the ecosystem intact and those things take care of it.
No, we have to work around it.
Yeah.
We're the intruders here.
Well, the final question for everybody, obviously, is just what was the last surfboard that you rode? But I rode it with you yesterday. So why don't we make it a broader conversation about yesterday's session? But let's say it's a Waikiki-esque wave. Reef break, casual reef break.
Yeah, just a South Shore spot in amongst a whole bunch of South Shore spots that wasn't crowded.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of a nice glidey wave. You know, when it's good out there, it's actually good.
Yeah.
And you just surf the outer part of it, and you get a, you know, a few good turns and a cutback, and it's kind of over. But like yesterday was more like Waikiki, where you could just stay in the white water and kind of start connecting little, you know, the swells as they popped up on each part of the reef as you rowed in. You know, and it's fun. Yeah, that's what surfing's become for me. It's just, it's supposed to be fun.
I mean, it was a kind of it was an epiphany session. I shouldn't say an epiphany, because I've had the epiphany a few times. Wasn't the first time I've had it, but it's like, man, this is so fun. Surfing is so fun. And often there's fear that you're combating, or there's just performance anxiety that you're combating, and all these things, or crowds that you're combating, and you're looking at a surf spot and there's various guys surfing that part of the reef and other ones. So you're making an assessment. Yesterday, it was like, we show up, the waves look small, and so it's like, oh, zero expectation.
Slightly onshore.
Riding a big board, so that's going to be easy. I have no expectation, no performance anxiety, no anything. Just go out there. And had the most fun ever. Like, had more fun doing that than I do when the waves are head high and good and I'm surfing well, quote unquote.
Yeah. Yeah. So, by the way, you're a good surfer.
Thank you.
You surf well.
Thanks. You loaned me a board. It was an 8.3. I don't even know what would you classify that board as?
It's my short board.
Yeah, because I mean, I almost want to tell listeners it's a fun board, but it's not. It has a pointy nose.
Well, yeah, but it's more of a hybrid-y nose. Yeah. You know, it's not a like a contemporary shortboard nose.
No.
But the board's 23.25 wide and a little over 3 thick. But it's my performance board.
Yeah, I'd say a foot back from the nose, it's pretty wide, but it comes to a point.
Yeah.
And paddles like a longboard. It was a quad fin setup. And it's like totally maneuverable. I was able to bank off sections, do kind of big cutbacks. But then also, when the wave was fat and slow, trying to connect with maybe an inside reef or like a wave that was coming from down the reef, the thing glided across flat water completely, almost like I was on a foil or something.
Yeah.
It was like crazy.
Well, did you notice we were going as far as the guys that were out there with us at the end on the foil?
Totally.
You know, so it was just like, hey, they got nothing on us.
Totally. And covering 100 yards at least.
Yeah.
I mean, covering
when you got a long
distance.
One, it's probably 140 yards.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a blast. But the question still remains, what was the last surfboard that you rode?
Well, I rode my 9-foot. Quad setup longboard, kind of a performance, you know, but it's wide. It's 23 something, and I think the nose is like 17. Tail's kind of pulled because I ride it on the North Shore as well as the South Shore.
Okay.
I've taken it to Mexico. Worked great at Cordon, that nice left point break down there and just north of Mazatlan. It kind of took a board, an 8-foot board that I had for years that had that same tail. Something about that tail that just works for me, you know, and it's not even a pin. It's just a radial tail, but pulled.
Okay.
And it just fits my style.
Is it built in Maui leaf-like construction?
It is not. It's just a regular poly.
Okay. Awesome.
Mostly because at first they didn't have the blanks that I wanted to use in the leaf-like, but I'm going to build myself a 9-foot leaf-like. Basically a duplicate of that board that I was riding yesterday. And then the same thing, I'm going to build something up. I'm going to attempt to go a little bit shorter than 8.3. Maybe crack the 8-foot mark, go to 7.11 or something. But it'll be the same board, but it's going to be a leaf light, so it floats a bit better.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, with that EPS, you'll get some of that buoyancy.
Yeah, and we'll see if I like it, you know, because I've been, you know, I'm not doing aerials. Weight's not that big of an issue for me.
Right.
And the light boards that I've had, they have a different feel. You know, the epoxies are tinny. And I don't know how else to put it. They just seem a little more, like they got a shell on them or something.
Yeah. Which mine doesn't feel that way. Because that was my concern as well. with this board that you made for me, and it doesn't feel that way. It feels damp in a, in a positive
way. Yeah, no, I think that's the hemp from on the whole deck. Okay. I think it really kind of dampens the whole thing.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you.
David, thank you. That was wonderful.
Adam. Wonderful. Thank you, Jeff Timpone. Much appreciated, and I appreciate your hospitality while my family and I were on Maui. Thank you, listeners, for all of your support. You can find everything that Jeff and I discussed on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. I'll link to Jeff's website and his social media and all that sort of stuff there. Check out his work. Order a Maui Leaf Light. They can get it to you for really inexpensively, actually, in terms of shipping from Maui to anywhere in the world. And then, of course, take advantage of Spy's generous $500 gift card giveaway this month. You've got 5 days left. We're going to pick one winner who uses the promo code podcast on spyoptic.com on November 20th. And then you'll have another opportunity between November 20th and December 20th, just in time to use that gift card for Christmas gift giving. I'm off to Charleston to go surf Folly Beach. It's actually kind of pumping right now. People are sending me photos and eager to surf that and see that. All right. Thanks again, David Scales, signing off, reminding you to get back into the water, share a couple of waves, and shred on.